A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say it's the most relatable prompt we've gotten in a while. He visited the Guinness Experience in Dublin, which, if you haven't been, is basically a cathedral to beer, and he spent the whole time fascinated by the industrial-scale fermenters and watching his pint settle. The actual explanation of how stout is made? Missed it entirely. So the questions he's left with are genuinely interesting ones. What is the actual secret behind Guinness's carbonation? Why does it feel so different from every other beer? How hard is it to homebrew a stout? And can you give him a starting recipe? And there's a wrinkle here, because Hannah apparently brewed a stout for their wedding, and Daniel thinks she finished it within a week, which, well, we'll get into why that timeline raises some eyebrows.
By the way, today's script is courtesy of Claude Sonnet 4.6, doing its usual thing behind the scenes.
It's working overtime, so Daniel doesn't have to. Right, so let's start where Daniel's attention actually landed, which is the carbonation. Because that silky creamy texture in a Guinness is not an accident, and it's not magic, and it is not the same thing as what's happening in a lager or even most ales. Most people assume Guinness is just a darker, heavier beer with less fizz. That's the misconception. The carbonation difference is not a style preference. It's a fundamentally different gas.
Right, and this is where it gets interesting from a physics standpoint. Most beers are carbonated with carbon dioxide. You dissolve CO2 into the liquid under pressure, you get bubbles, you get that familiar sharp fizzy sensation on your tongue. Guinness uses a blend, roughly 75% nitrogen and 25% carbon dioxide, and nitrogen behaves completely differently in solution. It's far less soluble than CO2, which means when you release that pressure by pouring, the nitrogen comes out of solution in a cascade of extremely fine, tiny bubbles, rather than the large, aggressive bubbles you get from a purely CO2 carbonated beer.
That's what creates the visual thing. The surge. The way it looks like it's raining upward inside the glass.
The bubbles are so small and so numerous that they actually appear to fall along the sides of the glass due to the way fluid dynamics work inside that particular glass shape. The cascade is real physics. And those tiny bubbles, when they reach the surface, they form a dense, persistent foam head rather than a loose, airy one. That head on a Guinness isn't just cosmetic. It contributes to the mouthfeel of every sip because you're drinking through it.
The creaminess isn't from the beer itself being thick or heavy. It's from the nitrogen foam changing the texture of what you're tasting.
That's a big part of it. The actual body of Guinness is not as thick as most people assume. The roasted barley gives it bitterness and those coffee and chocolate notes, but the nitrogen infusion is doing a lot of the work on perceived mouthfeel. And the carbonation level itself is kept quite low, around 1.2 volumes of CO2, compared to something like a typical American lager, which sits around 2.5 to 2.7. So you're getting less than half the CO2, but the nitrogen is filling that sensory role in a completely different way.
To put that in terms people might feel in their body, rather than just understand intellectually, that difference in CO2 level is a big part of why you can drink several pints of Guinness without feeling like you swallowed a balloon. The bloating you get from heavily carbonated lagers is largely the CO2 off-gassing in your stomach. Guinness is doing much less of that.
Which is one of those things that sounds like pub mythology until you actually look at the numbers and realize it's just chemistry. Lower dissolved CO2 means less gas escaping in your digestive system. The nitrogen doesn't behave the same way in your body that it does in the glass. It's not contributing to that bloated sensation in the same manner.
Guinness introduced the nitrogen infusion method in 1959, which I find remarkable because the widget in a can came much later, and that required solving a difficult engineering problem.
The widget is a great example of how much effort went into replicating the draft experience in a format where you couldn't control the pour. A small hollow plastic sphere with a tiny hole in it, pressurized with nitrogen, that releases a jet of nitrogen into the beer the moment you open the can. It agitates the beer and triggers that same cascade of fine bubbles. The patent on that technology is not trivial. Guinness spent years developing it, and the reason nobody had widely replicated the whole system before is partly that the infrastructure investment is significant. You need nitrogen gas, you need the right taps, the right lines, and you need to train people to pour correctly.
How long did it actually take them to get from the draft system to the widget? Because I feel like that's a gap most people don't think about.
About 30 years. The draft nitrogen system was 1959, and the widget wasn't commercially released until 1989. Guinness filed the patent in 88. So for 3 decades, if you wanted the real experience, you had to go to a pub with a properly maintained tap. The can was always a compromise, and making it a good compromise took the better part of a generation of engineering work.
30 years of people drinking flat, inadequate canned stout while the engineers worked on a plastic bowl. That's a very specific kind of patience.
When the widget launched, it was treated as a consumer technology story, not just a beer story. It won a Queen's Award for technological achievement in 1991. A beer can insert won a technology prize. That's how seriously the engineering was taken.
The pour itself being a 2-stage process, which I'm guessing Daniel watched very carefully while not listening to the explanation.
And the 2-stage pour matters because you fill the glass to about 3/4, you let it settle for about 90 to 120 seconds while that cascade completes, and then you top it up. If you rush it, you disrupt the foam structure before it's set. The physics of the settling are sensitive to interruption.
There's something almost meditative about watching it. I can see why it held his attention.
It's beautiful if you're watching the fluid dynamics, and the glass shape, that tulip curve, is not arbitrary either. It's designed to direct the flow of those nitrogen bubbles toward the center of the glass as they rise, which reinforces the cascade pattern and helps build the head evenly. You change the glass, you change the pour.
The full system is the gas blend, the pressure, the tap, the glass, the pour technique, and the settling time. Remove any one of those and you're not getting the same result.
Which is why home brewing a genuine nitrogen stout is legitimately difficult. You can brew something that tastes very similar. Getting the mouthfeel right is a different challenge entirely, and that's where we'll land when we get into the home brewing side of things. But the short version is that most home setups use CO2, and replicating the nitrogen cascade requires either a nitrogen tank and a stout faucet, or some creative workarounds that get you in the ballpark without quite hitting it.
Daniel's question about Hannah's wedding stout and the 1-week timeline, that's going to be an interesting one because a week is very fast for any stout worth drinking.
The general expectation for a standard session stout is somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks from brew day to drinkable, and that's if everything goes smoothly. 1 week suggests either it was not a stout or it was a stout that was consumed before it had finished doing what it needed to do.
Or, Hannah is a more aggressive brewer than either of us is giving her credit for.
That is also possible. She has surprised us before.
Right, so we've got a lot to get through. The science of the carbonation, the home brewing challenge, the wedding stout mystery, and a recipe Daniel can actually use. Speaking of stout, Herman, you've got some history on that, don't you?
Stout as a category is older than most people realize. The word itself originally just meant strong, as in a strong porter, and porter was already one of the dominant styles in 18th century London. What we now think of as dry Irish stout, the Guinness template, is a particular branch of that lineage that leaned heavily on roasted, unmalted barley, which gives it that sharp, almost acrid bitterness alongside the coffee and chocolate notes. That's the grain doing the work, not added flavoring.
The roasted barley is unmalted, which matters because malted and unmalted grain behave differently in the mash. Unmalted roasted barley doesn't contribute fermentable sugars the way malted grain does. It's contributing color, flavor, and body without adding much sweetness.
Which is part of why dry Irish stout sits lower in alcohol than people expect. Guinness Draft is around 4.2%. It's not a heavy beer by any measure. The perception of heaviness comes almost entirely from that nitrogen foam and the roast character, not from the alcohol or residual sugar content.
The misconception that stout is just a darker, stronger ale is doing real damage to people's expectations.
It's one of the more persistent ones in beer culture. Stout is not ale plus. It's a style with its own grain bill, its own fermentation character, and in Guinness's case, its own gas infrastructure. Arthur Guinness signed his famous 9,000-year lease on the St. James's Gate Brewery in Dublin in 1759, which is one of the more audacious real estate moves in brewing history, and the brewery has been evolving its process ever since. The nitrogen piece came 2 centuries later, but the roasted barley identity was locked in well before that.
9,000 years. He was either very confident or very optimistic about his product, or maybe both.
Yeah, probably both. What's remarkable about Guinness is that the confidence was eventually justified, which makes the audacity retrospectively look like vision. And the rent, by the way, was £45 per year for 9,000 years, which at some point stops being a lease and starts being a philosophical statement.
The landlord who accepted those terms is either the most trusting person in Irish history or deeply did not read the document.
Almost certainly the latter. But it does mean that legally, Guinness has the right to brew at St. James's Gate until the year 10,759, which I find delightful as a fact.
Let's get into the actual mechanics of the carbonation, because I think most people have heard the nitrogen explanation at a surface level, without really understanding what it's doing at each stage of the process.
The key thing is that nitrogen's low solubility is not a bug, it's the whole point. When you're serving a CO2 carbonated beer, the gas wants to escape aggressively. That's why you get that sharp, prickly sensation. Nitrogen doesn't want to be in the liquid in the first place, so when it does come out of solution, it does so in a very controlled, very fine dispersion. The bubbles nucleate on the inside surface of the glass rather than forming large clusters, and because they're so small, the surface tension of the liquid actually holds them together longer before they pop.
Which is why the head on a Guinness survives for so long compared to most beers. It's not a stylistic affectation. The bubble structure is physically more stable.
Right, and the persistence of that head matters for flavor delivery. Every time you take a sip, you're getting a small amount of that dense foam, which has a slightly different concentration of aromatic compounds than the liquid below it. The foam acts almost like a filter and an amplifier simultaneously. The roast notes, the coffee bitterness, those come through differently in the foam than they do in the body of the beer.
The nitrogen is shaping the flavor experience, not just the texture.
And the carbonation level being so low, around 1.2 volumes of CO2 compared to 2.5 or higher in most lagers, means that the sharpness that would otherwise compete with those roast flavors is largely absent. You're not fighting carbonic acid bite when you're trying to taste the roasted barley character. The whole system is tuned to let those flavors come forward cleanly.
The widget in the can is solving the same problem from a different angle. You can't use a nitrogen tap at home, so you engineer the nitrogen delivery into the packaging itself.
The engineering on that widget is clever. It's a hollow polyethylene sphere, roughly 3 centimeters across, with a small hole under 2 millimeters in diameter. During canning, the beer is filled under pressure with that nitrogen CO2 blend, and the widget fills with a small amount of liquid and pressurized nitrogen. When you open the can, the pressure differential forces a jet of nitrogen through that tiny hole into the beer at high velocity, which seeds the nucleation sites throughout the liquid and triggers the cascade. The whole settling process you see in a draft pour is reproduced in miniature inside the can before you even pour it into a glass.
You still need to pour it properly to get the full effect. Pouring into a glass activates another round of nucleation.
The widget does the initial work, but the pour and the glass shape complete it. The tulip glass, that outward curve below the rim, it's directing the rising nitrogen bubbles toward the center column of the liquid, which creates a rotational flow pattern that pushes the cascade outward and down along the edges. You get that visual effect of bubbles appearing to fall because the ones near the glass wall are being dragged down by the fluid dynamics of the central upward current. It looks counterintuitive, but it's entirely consistent with what the fluid is doing.
There's actually a famous study on this from researchers at the University of Limerick. They use computational fluid dynamics, modeling to map exactly what's happening inside the glass during the cascade. It confirmed that the downward flowing bubbles near the wall are a real fluid dynamic phenomenon, not an optical illusion. The glass shape is doing active work, not just looking nice.
It's one of those cases where the engineering and the aesthetics converged on the same solution. The glass that looks best for the pour is also the glass that performs best physically, which doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's satisfying.
The trade-off being that all of this requires infrastructure that doesn't transfer easily to a home setup. You need nitrogen, you need the right tap, the right lines, the right glass, and the patience to do a two-stage pour properly.
A venue willing to maintain all of it correctly, which is why a badly kept Guinness tap is such a specific kind of disappointment. The system has a lot of variables that can go wrong, and most of them are invisible until you taste the result.
Which sets up the homebrewing challenge rather neatly.
The homebrewing challenge with stout is real, but it's worth separating the nitrogen problem from the brewing problem, because you can brew an excellent stout at home without ever touching a nitrogen tank. What you can't do easily is replicate the mouthfeel of a draft Guinness. Those are two different goals, and conflating them is where a lot of beginners get discouraged.
What does the brewing side actually demand that makes stout harder than, say, a pale ale for someone starting out?
The grain bill is more demanding. You're working with roasted barley, which is unmalted and very dark, and it needs careful handling in the mash. If your mash temperature drifts too low, you lose body. Too high, and you get a beer that's cloying and thick in a way that doesn't taste intentional. The window for a dry Irish stout is roughly 148 to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, and where you land within that range has a significant effect on how much residual sugar survives into the finished beer.
Water chemistry matters here too, doesn't it? Dublin's water has a particular mineral profile.
It does, and this is something a lot of homebrew stout recipes underemphasize. Dublin water is relatively hard and has a higher bicarbonate content, which actually suits the roasted grain character. The alkalinity buffers the acidity that roasted barley introduces into the mash, which keeps the pH in a workable range and allows those dark flavors to come through without tipping into harsh or astringent. If you're brewing with very soft water and you don't adjust, your roasted barley can push the mash pH too low and you get a sharper, more acrid result than you want.
The recipe isn't just grain and hops. The mineral content of your water is part of the recipe.
Especially for a style this dependent on roast character. The fix is straightforward. You can add calcium carbonate to soften the acidity, but you have to know it's a variable in the first place. A lot of first-time stout brewers who get a harsh, acrid result blame the grain when it's actually the water.
Hannah's wedding stout allegedly finished in a week, which puts it well outside that 4 to 6 week window you mentioned. What actually happens to a stout that's rushed?
The yeast hasn't finished cleaning up after itself. During fermentation, yeast produces a range of byproducts alongside alcohol, and some of those, diacetyl being the main one, taste like artificial butter. The yeast will reabsorb most of those compounds if you give it time, but if you package the beer before that happens, those flavors are locked in. A 1 week stout is quite likely a buttery stout.
Which, to be fair to Hannah, she may have known and just decided the wedding was the deadline, and the deadline won.
That is a completely legitimate homebrewing decision. Plenty of great brewers have packaged something early because the event was coming. And a session stout with some green character is still drinkable, it's just not the beer it would have been with another 3 weeks of patience.
The other possibility is that it was a missed out. Daniel thinks it was, but Daniel was at his own wedding, which is not a situation that produces reliable tasting notes.
A porter would have looked and tasted similar enough to cause genuine confusion. Dark, roasty, not particularly sweet, and porters can move a bit faster because the grain bill is typically less aggressive. But without Hannah's recipe, we're speculating.
She's an architect. I imagine her brewing notes are either immaculate or completely non-existent.
Those do tend to be the two options. Now, on replicating the Guinness texture without full nitrogen infrastructure, there are a few approaches that get you meaningfully closer. One is oatmeal. Adding flaked oats to the grain bill increases the beta-glucan content of the beer, which adds a silky body that partially compensates for the absence of nitrogen foam. It's not the same effect mechanically, but the mouthfeel impression moves in the right direction.
Oats are doing physical work in the beer, not just flavor.
Mostly physical work, yes. They contribute some mild flavor, a slight creaminess, but the main job is texture. And there's a precedent for this in the commercial world. Oatmeal stout is a whole recognized substyle that dates back to the late 19th century, when oats were added partly for nutritional marketing reasons. But the texture benefit was real enough that the style survived long after the health claims were dropped.
Oatmeal stout is a Victorian health product is a sentence I was not expecting today.
It was a different era for marketing. Guinness itself ran advertisements for decades, suggesting the beer was good for you, including specifically recommending it to pregnant women and blood donors, which is a claim that would not survive modern regulatory scrutiny. But the oatmeal stout tradition has a more legitimate legacy in the texture it actually delivers.
The other approach for someone who wants to push toward the nitrogen effect without a dedicated nitrogen setup is a beer gas blend through a CO2 regulator, modified for mixed gas, which is getting into intermediate equipment territory. The simpler version is accepting that your homebrew stout is going to be a different experience than draft Guinness, and optimizing for what a home CO2 setup can actually deliver, which is a well-attenuated, roasty, dry stout with good bitterness and a clean finish.
Which sounds like it could be excellent in its own right.
It absolutely can be. The commercial comparison isn't always the useful one. A well-made, home-brewed dry stout, carbonated at a lower CO2 volume than you'd use for a pale ale, served cold in a tulip glass, is a very good beer. It's just a different experience than the nitrogen cascade. The mistake is chasing the Guinness experience specifically, rather than chasing a great stout.
Daniel, who watched the fermenters and skipped the explanation, is now in a position where the fermenters are the part he'd actually be recreating.
Which is maybe the most fitting outcome of the whole Guinness experience visit.
Which is maybe the most fitting outcome of the whole Guinness experience visit.
If someone listening to this actually wants to build those fermenters in miniature, what does the shopping list look like?
The good news is, the barrier is lower than most people assume. For a first stout, you need a fermenter, a kettle of at least 5 gallons, an airlock, an autosiphon, bottles or a keg, and a thermometer you actually trust. That's the core. The grain bill for a dry Irish stout is simple. Maris Otter or pale malt as your base, around 70 to 75% of the bill, then roasted unmalted barley for that coffee and dark chocolate character, around 10%, and flaked oats, another 10% for body. Finish with a small addition of chocolate malt, and you're close to the classic profile.
The oats are doing double duty here, texture and a mild flavor contribution.
Mostly texture, but yes. On the hop side, you want something neutral and bittering, Fuggles or East Kent Goldings, targeting around 30 IBUs. You're not trying to make the hops interesting, their background structure. Irish Ale Yeast, Wyast 184 or White Labs WLP-WL4 are the standard choices. They attenuate well and stay out of the way of the roast character, which is exactly what you want. One thing worth noting is that these strains can be a bit temperature sensitive. If you let fermentation run too warm, above about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, you can get some fruity esters that pull the flavor profile away from that clean, dry finish you're aiming for. Ferment cool and you'll get a cleaner result.
The carbonation side. Given everything we've covered about how hard it is to replicate the nitrogen effect.
Target around 1.5 to 1.8 volumes of CO2 when you're carbonating, lower than you'd go for a pale ale. It won't be the nitrogen cascade, but it keeps the carbonic bite down and lets the roast flavors come forward the same way the Guinness system is designed to do. Serve it cold, use a tulip glass, and pour with a slight angle. You're not going to get the widget effect, but you'll get a clean, dry, roasty stout that stands on its own. Realistically, 4 weeks minimum. 2 weeks of primary fermentation, at least 2 more of conditioning. That's where Hannah's wedding stout ran into trouble. The beer needs that second phase to clean up and settle.
The single most practical piece of advice is just, give it more time than you think it needs.
By a significant margin, yes. And if you're brewing it for an event, build the timeline backward from the date with at least a week of buffer. The worst outcome is a beer that's ready early and conditions a little longer. The best outcome of rushing is a beer that's fine. The worst outcome is a beer that tastes like movie popcorn butter.
Which, again, is a real possibility. Hannah navigated and made work through sheer force of wedding energy.
Weddings have a way of making everything taste better than it objectively is. The emotional context is doing a lot of work.
That patience problem is really the whole story. The chemistry doesn't care about your schedule.
It doesn't. Which is both the frustrating and the beautiful part of brewing. You can control almost everything, the grain, the water chemistry, the yeast pitch, the temperature, and then you just have to wait while the biology finishes what you started.
I find that philosophically comforting. The fermenters do the work. You just have to not open them too early.
That's essentially the entire skill compressed into one sentence.
Where do you think home stout brewing goes from here? Because the nitrogen infrastructure problem has been around for decades, and nobody's cracked a cheap consumer solution.
There are mixed gas regulators getting more accessible, and some of the smaller keg systems aimed at homebrewers are starting to support nitrogen blends. It's still not plug and play, but the gap is narrowing. I think the more interesting trend is brewers leaning into what home setups can actually do well, which is texture through ingredients rather than gas. Oat-forward stouts, milk stouts with lactose, craft takes on the style that don't try to be Guinness and are better for it.
The homebrew that stops apologizing for not being draft Guinness
starts being its own thing, which is where the best homebrewing usually ends up anyway. The homebrewer who tries to clone Guinness exactly is always going to be slightly disappointed. The one who uses the same grain philosophy but adapts it to what their setup can actually do is going to make something they're proud of. That's the better goal.
Honestly, that's true of most things you try to recreate at home. The copy is rarely as good as the original in the ways you're specifically trying to match, but it can be better in ways you weren't expecting.
The happy accident version of homebrewing, which is probably how half the interesting beer styles in history got invented in the first place.
Big thanks to Hilbert Flumingtopf for producing, and to Modal for the GPU time that keeps this whole pipeline running. If you've enjoyed this one, leaving us a review helps more people find the show. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at My Weird Prompts.
Go brew something.
Give it 5 weeks.
This episode's script was written by Claude Sonnet 4.6 with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.